Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of Book Therapy, the music and murder episode. I'm Rob Cohen, and we might as well get started right now. When I was 18 years old, my mom and dad bought tickets for my brother and I to go see what was called a rock opera playing at the Universal Amphitheater. My brother and I think, were fairly well-cultured, having seen many musicals and stage productions, starting when we were 5 or 6 years old with Peter Pan and Annie, certainly seen all of the highlights of Phantom of the Opera, Les Mis, Cats. We had frequently traveled to New York and seen Broadway shows while we were there, musicals, plays. But the idea of a rock opera was something that I'd never really come into contact with. And the Universal Amphitheater, to me, seemed to be somewhat of a strange place for a musical, because Universal Amphitheater was really a rock and roll concert type of a venue. But Mom and Dad saw the show previously, thought that my brother and I would like it, so they brought us tickets. So we went to the show, and it was exactly what it sounds like, a rock opera. It was a musical, but it was not with the same type of music that you would think of for customary Broadway shows, the violins and cellos and harps and things like that. No, this was rock and roll music. It was a stage production, a full story with a script, speaking dialogue, and instead of the heartwarming and sensitive songs with the backing vocals, background music of pianos and things like that, it was actually raging guitars, pounding drums, and rock and roll singing. And of course, the show I'm talking about is the rock opera, The Who's Tommy. Prior to my 18th birthday, prior to seeing the show, I didn't really know a whole lot about the band The Who. And I certainly had never heard anything about the character Tommy. However, when I mentioned it to my parents, the response was, of course, he's that deaf, dumb, and blind kid who plays pinball. And I remember asking my dad to repeat that because it didn't seem to make any sense what he had just said. I said, I'm sorry, Dad, say that again. Oh, yeah, he's a deaf, dumb, and blind kid who plays pinball. Now, the only people I knew of who were deaf and blind were Helen Keller, and I certainly could not have pictured her playing pinball. So, playing along with the gag, I said, Dad, how does a deaf, dumb, and blind kid play pinball? And Dad said, well, it must have been by a sense of smell. Well, not knowing that this was what the Who's Tommy was all about, thinking that Mom and Dad were pulling a fast one on us, we went to the show and obviously were just completely blown away. The music was outrageous. The story was bizarre. But there was something infectious about the music, something infectious about the rock and roll aspect of the show. There was something about the portrayal of the characters and the way that the story was set to this intoxicating music, which really resonated with me to the point where I became incredibly interested in the music itself. So after the show ended at Universal Amphitheater, I remember we walked straight to the Virgin Megastore that used to be there, purchased the soundtrack for the show, and also purchased a CD for The Who's Greatest Hits. Keep in mind, this was 1994, 1995, thereabouts, and The Who had pretty much been irrelevant for 14 or 15 years. So we pretty much felt like we were buying music of a band which was dead, a band that was only played on the oldies station and really had no current or contemporary interest or application. But we knew that the music in the rock opera was astounding. Figured if it was came from the same band, it had to be good. So we bought the Greatest Hits album, and we really enjoyed the Greatest Hits album. And the songs, you know them all, were really, really kind of infectious. And I remember we spun that CD around many, many times, getting used to the music and really learning all those songs. As time went by, The Who seemed to have lost any type of relevance yet again after Tommy pretty much closed his doors and stopped touring. And it was only within the last decade or so that I think that the Who gained a resurgence, so to speak, for what may seem to be the most ridiculous of reasons, that be the CSI shows. As you understand, or as you know, the CSI, CSI Miami, CSI New York, they utilize songs from the Who's catalog as their opening and closing credit songs. And I remember distinctly watching the very first episode of CSI Miami as the initial crime takes place. As soon as David Caruso gives his silly, cliched statement about finding the murderer, this huge theatrical rock and roll scream of Roger Daltrey penetrated my eardrums, got my attention, and quickly focused me on the TV show. And I think from that point on, The Who gained, like I said, a bit of a resurgence to the point where they were playing the Super Bowl halftime show a couple years ago. They played the 2012 Olympic Games closing ceremonies and seemed to have found a way to touch younger listeners where they had really failed to be relevant for the last almost 30 years. Other than listening to the music and seeing the scattering of appearances that Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend would make, I didn't know anything about the band. I didn't know anything about the drummer or the bass player, who seemed to have disappeared for one reason or another. They weren't ever shown alongside of Daltrey and Townsend. And I certainly didn't know anything about the root of the songs, where the Deaf, Dumb, and Blind Kid came from, what the Squeeze Box song is about, what Bob O'Reilly is about. I knew nothing about this. And the only attention that the band got, I think, between the mid-90s and the mid-2000s was negative attention, which was, if my timing is right, when Pete Townsend was, for whatever reason, arrested, having to do with child pornography. And I don't remember when the specific year was. Maybe it was sometime within the middle 2000s. So whatever publicity The Who had had from the time I was 18 to the present was either negative because of Pete Townsend's arrest or was associated with the CSI TV shows. Well, late 2012, Pete Townsend releases his autobiography called Who I Am, and enjoying the music as much as I did and having no clear knowledge of the root of the band, where it came from, how it started, the level of its success, or what any of these songs really meant, I was eager to pick up the book. And I seem to have been getting into a little mini phase lately of rock and roll memoirs, because I also recently read the autobiography of John Taylor from Duran Duran called In the Pleasure Groove, I think is what it was. And that was a little bit of a different reading experience for me, because Duran Duran was a band that I grew up with. It was the first band that I fell in love with from MTV as a 7 or 8 year old, not really knowing anything about the world, not knowing anything about a group from London, where England was on the map, a band that seemed to travel the world, conduct concerts in Sydney, Australia, shoot videos in Sri Lanka. This was a band that to me was about as exotic as you got. And the book was for me an opportunity to relive a little bit of my childhood, to get to know a little bit better the five members of the band, to go through their career with them, because as their career grew, I grew as well, and to the point where their career became established, to the point where I was certainly more established in my music listening and what I liked. But Pete Townsend, The Who, was a different story. And I was really hoping that through this book I would gain a little bit more insight into what the songs were about, where the story idea for Tommy came about, what Quadrophenia was about, and really find out also about the two unknown to me members of the band, the bass player and the drummer, who seem to have been forgotten whenever The Who play live. This was not that book. And after having read the John Taylor book and then reading this book, I feel that my expectations for those books is misplaced. Because what I'm looking for is something akin to an MTV Storytellers, where the band sits on stage, talks about what the song means, talks about the writing process and how it came about, plays the song, lets you revel in the nostalgia of it, and then goes on to the next song. And that just was not what this was. This was a story about Pete Townsend. And all of the other characters, all of the other people who came in and out of his life, including his band members, they were all somewhat tangential to the story. Because throughout his career, it seems that Pete Townsend had been trying to establish himself as something other than the lead guitarist of The Who. He always seemed to have other ideas for new technologies, for branching off into other media, for writing songs for himself, for writing rock operas, for writing musicals that were really an attempt, I think, for him to distance himself from his affiliation from and notoriety as a member of The Who. But I learned a whole lot about Pete Townsend that I never really expected to learn. Among those, I guess my initial impression about Pete Townsend is that he seems to be an egotistical, self-centered, narcissistic bastard. He does not come off likable. He seems to have questionable morals, especially when it came to the rock and roll lifestyle. He allowed his drug use and rampant sexuality to be excused away as being what a rock star does, living the rock star life. It appears that he was a terrible father to at least his two daughters, who were already in their mid-teens before he had a third child. And it seems as if all his career he's been cloying for some sort of approval, for somebody to tell him that he's smart, for somebody to validate what he already thinks of himself. And after a while, the book starts to get boring because he seemed to enjoy telling the reader how creative he was with respect to the establishment of his home studio and what equipment he used and how he stacked his speakers and which kind of guitar he used and what the speakers were. And it just got to the point where it felt like he was trying to prove to everybody that he really was this rock and roll genius. And I think that for anybody who knows the music or has listened to the music, they probably would tell you that there is a level of genius to the music itself. The groundbreaking nature of the electric guitar and his use of the guitar, the multi-leveled soundtracks, the lyrics. This was not just three-chord punk. There was really something fairly weighty to it. There was a lot of depth to the music. And I think that everybody understood that he was the mastermind behind the band as far as its creativity and was due a whole lot of credit for it. So to now take a 500-page autobiography and on basically every page reinforce how smart he really was, it got to be a little bit oppressive. Now, as I've heard with a lot of hyper geniuses, that they have sometimes an ineptitude for social interaction and empathy. And it seems through the reading of this book that that may be what Townsend suffers from. Because at times in his life where tragedy has struck or pain has been inflicted, he treats them with very little sensitivity. I had known after a while of looking into it, I learned that the two other members of the band had died. The drummer Keith Moon, who I guess had a reputation for being just an incredibly hard partier and frequent and overwhelmingly abusive drug user. And the bass player John Entwistle, who I really didn't know a whole lot about. But as far as Keith Moon went, there had been talk for the last 10, 15 years that Mike Myers of Austin Powers fame would be making a movie biography of Keith Moon. So I already knew that there was some story there to the hard-living, fast-dying rock and roll drummer life that Keith Moon lived. So I was hoping to get some insight into that through this book. But it didn't really come, because Townsend spent so much time talking about himself and less time talking about his interactions with the rest of the band members, to the point where when he learned of Keith Moon's death, he doesn't describe a whole lot of emotion. It doesn't seem like there was a whole lot of sadness. It doesn't seem as if when he learned of Keith's death, he fell to the floor in tears and was racking himself with sobs and was unable to get a hold of himself because one of his best friends, the people who he toured around the world with for the past 10 years or so, or 15 years, had died. There was none of that. And so it felt a little bit distended from what I perceive as the close-knit grouping of a rock and roll band. Now, there was a little bit more emotion when Pete Townsend describes how he felt when he learned that John Entwistle had died, because I think he felt a little bit of sadness for John, but also a little bit of pity for John, because I never got the feeling through the descriptions in the book that John Entwistle was really the trailblazer when it came to the drug use and the alcohol, that he was more following the lead of Keith Moon, and that he was not as much the huge proponent for the hard partying life that Keith Moon was. But I also felt that there was a pity from the fact that Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey seemed to have been okay with respect to keeping track of their money, and yet John Entwistle passed away during a tour that had been put on, a reunion tour, for the purpose of getting more income to help John Entwistle, who seemed to be living in abject poverty. So I got the feeling that when John Entwistle died, there was some feeling of loss on the part of Pete Townsend, but I kind of interpreted that loss as being the feeling of how one feels when they see a stray puppy dog, that here was a sad, helpless individual who was not able to take care of himself, who seemed to follow in the footsteps of those who really were leading him down the wrong path, had spent all of his money trying to keep up with the Joneses, and then died basically penniless and without any redemption, so to speak. So there was a little bit of a glimpse that Townsend has a conscience, that he has a sensitivity. But his treatment of his wife of 25 years, until he eventually divorced her, is so horrific and tragic. And yet he seems to be completely oblivious to the fact of how terrible of a husband he was and how much pain he must have put his wife through. And this obliviousness is really evident in the acknowledgments to the book, the end and closing paragraphs, where he talks about the character, the people who he wants to thank and acknowledge in the writing of the book. And he says this about his ex-wife. He says, "My ex-wife, Karen, the rightful beneficiary of a rather splendid divorce settlement, now runs an art gallery, yada, yada, yada. Karen is another who, like Roger, would have preferred that this book had never been published. Not for squeamish reasons, but perhaps because so much of our life together was so wonderful. I hope so." There was nothing in this book that indicates that his life with his wife Karen was wonderful. In fact, I think he's so deluded by his entire life and the way he treats people, because he fails to see what the reader, I think, clearly would understand, that the reason why Karen didn't want this book to be written is because she didn't want publicized how poorly she was treated and how she never got out of this, she didn't get out of the divorce soon enough. Because he talks about his rampant drug use, Townsend does. He talks about, the wild sex he had while on tour. He talks about lusting over his friends' girlfriends. He talks about seeing people across the room and going over to them and picking up on them. He talks about the long days and years on tour. He talks about the hours and hours and hours of time that he spent sitting in his studio making music or writing lyrics. He talks about the properties that he purchased and the boats that he bought so he could spend more time basically by himself. And yet he thinks that the reason why Karen didn't want the book written was because of all the great times they had together. I mean, it's just completely delusional. I mean, it really doesn't make any sense. And throughout the book, I kept taking Karen's side and feeling so incredibly ashamed for her that she grinned and bared it, so to speak, for so long. And I'm sure the money was good, but there were times when the money wasn't good, and he admits there were times when the money wasn't good. And yet he seems to have never been there. He had two daughters who he seems, at least from the book, not to have had any type of a connection with. He left the kids at home with his wife. She raised the kids. She was working on becoming a teacher, and she basically kept the house. And he was off traveling the world. And if he wasn't traveling the world, he was at parties with friends and picking up on women. And if he wasn't there, he was at a studio, either at an office, on a boat, at another home, or even the studio in his own home, making music and writing lyrics and trying to create the next best thing. So I don't know what aspect of that conveys that there was some wonderful relationship between he and Karen. Now, it may have been there, and he may have chosen to either edit it out or simply not discuss any of that, but then you're only getting one side of the story, and it's not the flattering picture. Now, the other aspect of it, which I didn't quite grasp from the book, was what his relationship with Roger was really like. Because it seems from the book that Pete Townsend seems would be an incredibly difficult person to be around and get along. Somebody who seems to always know the answer, seems to be directing everybody, and he really gives off the impression that he was the mastermind for the Who. He was one who wrote the vast majority of the songs. He created the vast majority of the music. And the rest of the three band members pretty much just went along with whatever he said. Now, if that's the case, fine. I have a little bit of a hard time picturing that, because Pete Townsend does talk about Roger Daltrey earlier on in the book as being a little bit of a fighter. So I can only imagine that Roger and Pete had to have butt heads at some point, on probably on many occasions, but he doesn't discuss all that. It's more about how focused and devoted he was to his craft and to the expectation that everybody would just fall in line with whatever he wanted. And I don't know whether the drugs and the alcohol were playing a huge part of that, because some of the stuff, as he's talking about them, a deaf, dumb, and blind kid who plays pinball, do you really mean to tell me that, you know, rational thinking people, I mean, think that this is a good idea? I mean, come on, there's got to be some drugs there. And that was kind of what I was hoping for. I had to expect that the creation of this character, this rock opera, had to have been a product of drugs and alcohol, because some of it is so bizarre. And especially after you've seen the movie. I mean, the movie is just, it seems to be a roller coaster of LSD and drug use. And if that's a true and faithful depiction of what life was like in the late 60s and early 70s, I mean, I feel bad for those people, because it seems to be just completely bizarre. But what's interesting is I didn't see the movie version of Tommy until after I'd seen the stage show. And whereas I fell in love with the stage show and really appreciated the way that it was depicted on stage, it seemed to me to be much more straightforward and understandable. And that the concept of the deaf, dumb, and blind kid who plays pinball could theoretically have been a metaphor for any one of the children who feel as if they have a great talent that their parents don't see. The movie version was something that I really couldn't even get through because of how outlandish it all seemed. And yet Townsend tells us in his book that Roger hated the stage version. So what the hell do I know? But after I finished the Duran Duran book, the John Taylor book, I had this real need to listen to that music again, to feel the nostalgia for my childhood, to listen to Hungry Like the Wolf, to listen to Rio, to listen to Girls on Film, and to transport myself back to that time, to, after having now read the autobiography, get a better picture of what was going on in John Taylor's life when these songs were being written. I didn't feel that same type of a need after I finished the Townsend book. Sure, I've got a couple of Who songs on my iPod. I have certainly some of the CDs, but I didn't feel that urge to blast Love Rain Over Me as loud as I can, to play We Won't Get Fooled Again and listen to that guttural, vicious rock and roll scream again. I really didn't feel it. And in fact, I was really kind of turned off to the music, because I like to think of bands, and I don't know the music industry at all. I certainly have no musical talent and can't. I'm astounded at people who have musical talent and can write songs. But I like to think of the songwriting process as a group working together, putting out the music, coming up with the bass, coming up with the drums, coming up with the guitars, writing the lyrics together as a real teamwork exercise. And from Duran Duran, I could picture that. I that was how it was relayed in the book, that Nick Rhodes would put down the keyboards, and John Taylor would come in with the bass, and Roger would bang out a beat, and then Simon would write the lyrics to go with it, and it was much more of a collaborative process. So there was a kind of a family aspect to the band that I just didn't get from The Who, from Pete. I didn't see that. I saw what felt more like a dictator who comes in with the music all written, comes in with the lyrics already put together, and hands it out to everybody and says, all right, this is what we're playing. And it just felt much more like a business, much more like an artist trying to prove to everybody how smart he is and how talented he is. And I guess from that standpoint, I did learn a little bit about who Pete Townsend is. But he doesn't seem to be anybody I'd like to be friends with, I can tell you that. So, moving on, the second book I want to talk about tonight is a book called Defending Jacob by William Landay. I think it's Landay, L-A-N-D-A-Y. This one was written last year, 2012, and it was a huge, huge success. Bestseller on many, many best of lists. So many people were talking about it, and I resisted it. I stayed away from it. I didn't want anything to do with it, and I felt like I had a pretty good reason. In 1989, when I was 13 years old, I had pretty much graduated to big boy books. I had finished with the kid books, finished with whatever young adult books that were out there, and I had graduated to the bestsellers. And one of the first books that I picked up was a book called Presumed Innocent by Scott Turow. And this was a book that really turned me on to two different paths of my life. One was to legal fiction, and the second was to the path that eventually brought me to becoming an attorney. Because Presumed Innocent really opened my eyes to the intelligence of the attorneys. And it wasn't so much the crime aspect of the book and the mystery of the murder and the trial. It was the way that the characters thought, the way that they spoke, the way that the attorney strategized was something which was brand new to me, was incredibly enticing, and I really gravitated towards that and felt that that was where I envisioned my life's work going, to becoming an attorney and learning how to think in that way, learning how to strategize. Well, after Presumed Innocent, I pretty much devoured as many legal thrillers as I could find. I read all the John Grisham books. I started with the Steve Martini books. I read Philip Friedman. I read just about anything I could get my hands on. And after a while, I started to get burnt out from them. And that burnout really pretty much coincided with my beginning law school. Because at that time, I felt like it was a little bit of overload. I'm learning the law at school, and I'm coming home and I'm reading books about the law. And I kind of just needed to take a step back, take a little bit of a break, and go on to other things. Stay out of the courtroom. Because on top of being overloaded, it actually started to create in me a little bit of stress. Because I could feel the stress that the characters were under. Because now I'd been through moot court. I'd been through trial practice. And I'd actually stood in front of a jury, even though they were jury of my friends, and given a closing argument. I cross-examined a quote-unquote witness. And so when I'd read these legal thrillers, I actually felt the stress. And there was no release for me. There was no relaxation. This was not my getaway book like I turned to in order to escape from the world. So I stayed away from legal thrillers. And in fact, I've pretty much maintained some consistency in that respect, even though I'm now 13 years out of law school, to the point where I really only will delve into the legal thriller arena on two occasions, those being if it's a Steve Martini book and if it's a Michael Connelly book involving his lawyer character, Mickey Haller. So when Defendant Jacob came out last year and it gotten all the acclaim and attention, I really wasn't interested because it's just another one of those legal thrillers. I'll stay away from it. I don't really need it. I've got plenty of other things to read. But I saw it last week at the bookstore. It's now out in paperback. And for some reason, there was something about it, I can't even tell you what it was, that screamed, pick me up and read me. And so I, interestingly enough, raced through the Pete Townsend book in order to get to Defending Jacob. And here's where I'm going to offer a caveat. If you have not read the book and you are interested in reading the book, stop listening because there will be spoilers. I can't rant and rave about the book without giving you some spoilers. So I'm giving you fair warning. You will be told a little bit more of the secrets of the book than you know from reading the back cover. So keep that in mind. Okay, so with that in mind, first off, the thing about the book that I was a little bit disappointed in was I felt somewhat deceived by everything I'd heard about the book. Because my understanding was that the main character is a district attorney, has a son, his son is accused of murder, and this district attorney becomes defense attorney for his son and defends his son in court. That's not what happened. So right off the bat, there was a little bit of a, oh, well, then, you know, that would have been a really cool book if it had gone that way, but it didn't really go that way, so kind of a little disappointed by what my preconceived expectations were. The second aspect of the book that I found a little bit distracting is that it feels to be very, very close to presumed innocent. Now, presumed innocent was 25 years ago, and it's possible that the generation of readers today don't remember presumed innocent, haven't read it, and don't really know the history of that book as being the trailblazer for the 25 years of legal thrillers we've had since then. There wouldn't be a John Grisham without a presumed innocent. There wouldn't be any of those other really successful legal thriller genre authors if it hadn't been for Scott Turow and Presumed Innocent. So me understanding how important Presumed Innocent was not only to myself as a reader and a future lawyer, but also to the publishing world as a whole, I was immediately in tune to the similarities between this book and Presumed Innocent. I mean, one of the characters, a very, very, very minor character, so don't go overboard with that. One of the characters' names is Rusty, and Rusty was the name of the main character in Presumed Innocent. That close. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the author of Defending Jacob said, Presumed Innocent was one of my favorite books, and yes, that was my incentive or influences for writing this book. So I'm going to at least offer that as a potential excuse, so I can understand that. But the stories are in some way, they track each other. Presumed Innocent is a story of a district attorney named Rusty who is investigating the murder of a colleague of his, another district attorney, and as he is going through the investigation, it turns out that all of the evidence is pointing at him as being the murderer. Turns out that he had had a sexual relationship with the deceased, and in fact ends up being put on trial for the murder. And in this one, the main character, Andrew Barber, is a district attorney. He is investigating the murder of a 14-year-old child who happens to be a student at the school that his own, Andrew Barber's own 14-year-old son goes to, the aforementioned Jacob. And as Andy is going through his investigation, there appears to be a parallel investigation going on without Andy's knowledge, and the decision is made to arrest and indict Jacob for the murder of the 14-year-old kid named Ben. So, slight differences from Presumed Innocent, but not significant differences that a reader familiar with that project would not see the similarities. Because the similarities don't end there. The additional similarity is the prosecuting attorney at the trial itself. In Presumed Innocent, it was one of Rusty's colleagues who happened to be a step below him, who is now trying to make his claim for being next in line to become the district attorney. In defending Jacob, the prosecutor is a colleague of Andy's who is a little bit below him, who sees this as an opportunity not only to take out his immediate predecessor, the one directly above him, but also set him up for potentially running for the district attorney's office. So, I mean, it's pretty similar, the two of them. While the story is being told, is unraveling, it's actually being told in flashback. The whole thing is told in flashback. And it's interspersed with testimony, grand jury testimony that Andy is giving. And the reader is unaware of why he is being questioned under oath in front of the grand jury. We don't know whether he is being charged with something or if somebody else is being charged with something. We know that it takes place after the testimony takes place after the trial of the son Jacob. We don't know what the result is. We just know that there is something else that happened after the trial that basically continued the story and continued Andy's involvement in the murder of the 14-year-old kid. Now, I could talk a little bit about the specifics of the trial itself. I can talk about why I was disturbed by the events of the trial, why I felt that nobody seemed to do a good job at all. The prosecutor, the investigating police officers, or even the defense attorney. And that might be a little bit of trial strategy and tactics. It also is colored by my prior readings of the other legal thrillers, where I've actually read some incredible cross-examinations of the medical examiners, the evidence regarding the method of death, the lividity of the skin, the angle from which the killer must have committed the crime, blood spatter, all this kind of stuff, which was going through my head as I'm reading the book, that is not really being focused on during the trial, and could have, by the way, exonerated the kid. And yet all along, we have to keep in the back of our mind the knowledge that this isn't a novel told from the standpoint of the fly on the wall. This is a first-person account from a participant in the story. And we have to take the recitation of events with a grain of salt. And there's a term that I've heard in literature that I like and I don't like. I have kind of this love and hate relationship with it. And it is the terminology unreliable narrator. Because in a third person type of a story, there is no unreliable narrator. It's just being it's a recitation of events. But in a first person account, the reader has to do one of two things. Reader has to accept that they're being told the truth, or has to believe that they're going to be misled at some point, and thereby they question everything that they're told. And to me, it seemed as if the writer was dropping hints along the way that Andy was not to be believed. I just felt it. There were points in the story when people would question him about why he was so confident that Jacob was going to be exonerated for the crime, and his response would be not justice would be done, not that the system will protect him, that the system will work the way it should, not that he had faith in the system, not that he believed that his son was innocent, not that he believed that his son could not have committed this crime. No, his reasoning for why he believed that Jacob would be exonerated was because Jacob didn't do it. That's very clear. Jacob didn't do this. Now, as parents, we can say, well, we believe we know our kids well enough to feel comfortable that they wouldn't do something. They wouldn't commit this type of crime. They wouldn't cheat on a test. They wouldn't push down a kid on the playground. But we don't really know. We like to think that we have done a good job as parents, that our kids were brought up with the right set of morals, that they wouldn't do these kinds of things. But that would be, if somebody said to me, did your daughter kill this kid? You know what? I truly believe that he didn't that she didn't, because I know that I brought her up well to know right from wrong, and to know that pushing down a kid on the playground or killing somebody is wrong. But I don't know that I'd be able to say I know she didn't do it. I can categorically state that she didn't do it. So as Andy is saying these things to the reader, my response is, how do you know? I'm not challenging you. I'm not saying, how do you know? Give me some sort of a explanation founded in the evidence. How do you know? The only reason you could know for sure is because you know who really did it. Now, in Presumed Innocent, that was a clear example of the shocking reveal. Because in Presumed Innocent, we're not sure if Rusty did it or not. We know that he had a friend of his bend the rules a little bit, maybe destroy some evidence that could have convicted Rusty. And even though we're told by Rusty, if I remember correctly, that he didn't do it, or we as a reader want to believe he didn't do it, we don't really know for sure until the very end. And then the twist comes, and we find out the truth, and we're both surprised and disgusted by it. But having been conditioned by Presumed Innocent to distrust the first-person narrator, especially the first-person narrator who is intimately involved in the scenes itself, I was wary that I couldn't take everything that Andy said as the gospel. So in reading that, or in having that thought process, you start to read a little bit differently. You start to look at the words. You start to look at the character names. You start to look at some of the events that transpire and how Andy handles them. Now, there's an interesting thing. I wonder if this was intentional or not, but the prosecuting attorney, his name was Logudice, Logudice. And on the first or second page of the book, Andy takes great pains to not only tell us what his name is, but to give us the phonetic spelling so we know how to say it. I have always had a soft spot for Neil Logudice, pronounced La Ju, J-O-O-Dis, D-I-S. Well, what's interesting to me is, and I don't know if this means anything, but what the hell, I'm going to tell you anyways. If you take Logudice, I think you assume that he's Italian. So not knowing a whole lot of Italian, but understanding some of the Romance languages from the standpoint of Spanish and French, lo, la, le, as being the, you take lo Judas and you dissect it, take out lo as being the, you've got Judas. Now, I'm Jewish. I don't know a whole lot about Christian religion from the standpoint of the circumstances leading to Jesus' crucifixion, but I do seem to recall that there was a character named Judas who had a lot to do with it. So I'm not sure if that has a lot of meaning in this book, but I thought it was kind of interesting just that the name Lo Judas and Judas, and did Judas have something to do with the downfall of Jesus? Does Lo Judas have something to do with the downfall of Andy Barber? I don't know. That was interesting. But anyways, looking at the book as a whole, reading certain of the passages, looking at the way that that Andy takes steps that seem to be for the purpose of protecting his son, but on a second look may potentially have been for the purpose of protecting himself, I begin to wonder how reliable Andy is as a narrator for this story. So I'm not going to go into the rest of the details of the story. Suffice it to say, Jacob is exonerated. The circumstances of his exoneration are a little bit too simple for me. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of the presentation of a defense, but due to other circumstances, Jacob is exonerated. But you're still not sure whether Jacob did it. And after this family, which has been so torn apart by the trial, so torn apart by the accusations of their son's murder, they decide to take a vacation down to Jamaica. And while they're there, Jacob meets and seems to develop a little bit of a relationship with another girl. And the girl ends up dead. And you're supposed to be leading up to the conclusion that perhaps Jacob really did kill the boy, because it seems like he would have killed the girl as well. Now, I don't want to give away the ending as far as what the issue of the grand jury investigation was. And you're left with this lingering doubt as to whether Jacob actually was the murderer, if he killed the kid, if he had killed the young girl as well. But I have a different perspective on this. And here's what it is. The name of the book is called Defending Jacob. And now I've already told you that Andy Barber, as an attorney, does not actually do any defense work on Jacob's behalf. He's at the counsel table during the trial, but he does no questioning. He is not present for any sidebar visits with the judge. He does not seem to have any input as to the strategy. So we go back to the name of the book, Defending Jacob. Well, we learned that Jacob seems to have been a little bit of an outcast during his schooling, that the boy who had been killed was basically a bully, calling Jacob nasty names, teasing him, making accusations about him and his sexual proclivities. And you really get the feeling that this poor kid, who may have been antisocial, may have had difficulties interacting with other kids, may not have had a lot of friends, that he was a victim of bullying. And as a parent, I've often thought how pleasant it would be to go back and be a kid again, that the real life of an adult, of the grind of work and bills and taxes and insurance and everything that an adult has to deal with, is something that really should be put off as long as possible, and to be a kid as long as possible. But reading a book like this, which is really descriptive of Jacob's school life and the way that it appears he was bullied and how kids treated him, I don't really get the warm and fuzzy nostalgia for my own childhood, and I don't really envy what my kids are going to be going through. I can only hope that they are treated well, that they treat other people well, and that they really don't have to experience what bullying is all about. But then I take it from the standpoint of, what if they were being bullied? And then I put myself into Andy Barber's position. Andy is a district attorney. He has seen, and I think he tells you how many hundreds of homicides he has been witness to at the crime scene and has tried. If anybody knows how to get away with a murder, it very possibly could be Andy. And I go back to the name of the book, defending Jacob. And I just, I can't help but wonder that the name of the book does not mean defending him at defending Jacob at his trial, but maybe defending Jacob with respect to his bullies. And that maybe Andy is the one who actually committed the murder. Because Andy tells you during the story that the location of the murder is a place where he used to run a lot. It was over in a park. It's on the way to school. Andy tells you he used to go running, and that was the location where he went to. There was certainly a lot of talk about the knife that was used in the murder. The fact that Jacob himself did not exhibit any outward signs of having been participated in the murder. There's no blood anywhere, things like that. So I just wonder how much of an involvement Andy really had in the murder. And that, I think, comes to really one of the purposes of this podcast. I don't know anybody else who's read this book, and yet I needed to talk about it because I needed to tell somebody, hey, I think Andy's the one who did it. Now, I don't have an explanation. I admit, I don't have an explanation for what happened to the girl at the end of the story. I don't. It's possible it was just a coincidence. It's possible it was just a way to misdirect the reader, to put the reader on a different path. I don't know. But I got to tell you, something back there is telling me that Andy had more to do with this murder than he let on. And because he's the narrator, he can give us whatever information he wants to give us. And if he wants to tell us the truth, he can tell us the truth. And if he wants to give us enough information so that it's clear that Jacob didn't do it, but it's not clear who did, then he has that right as well. He's just that unreliable narrator who, at the end of the day, you're just not sure whether you got the whole story. And I really, really would have liked this book more if I had not read Presumed Innocent. Not that I had not read Presumed Innocent, because Presumed Innocent was 25 years ago. It's possible that people who read Presumed Innocent 25 years ago don't remember it. But Presumed Innocent had such a monumental impact on me that it's really one of those books that I have not been able to forget. Not that I've been trying, but it's one of those books that is going to stay with me for a while. So with that being said, its similarities to defending Jacob's seeming mirroring of a lot of the storylines and tactics employed in Presumed Innocent, it really took away from my enjoyment of the book. Just as a side note, one of the things that was always disturbing about the book is that it takes place in Newton, Massachusetts. And every time I would see the word Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, I would think about Newtown and the tragedy that occurred there just a few months ago. So, and the tragedy that involved, obviously, children. And in defending Jacob, you've got a 14-year-old boy who's killed. The similarities to that were not so extreme, but it was enough to at least make me think back to what happened over at Newtown. So that was a little bit distracting as well. But anyways, that's Book Therapy for this week. Next time, you'll have a perspective on James Bond, because I just started reading Goldfinger by James Bond. By Ian Fleming, which involves, obviously, 007 James Bond. So we'll talk about that next time. This is Rob Cohen. You can find me at RobCohen13 on Twitter. You can find me at booktherapy.podbean.com. You can find me on iTunes. You can also find me on Facebook. And you can find me on my blog at robcohen13.com. And thank you for letting me lie on your couch.